depends if you can pay more than the NSA.
I meant NSA by we.
Are you something in the drums that you're doing?
Yeah, just put it here. Yep, problem set. Oh. This is the problem set, and this is the project for us. But this is the problem set. Okay. Problem set. Yep, proposals go over here.
Then this is the project. This is the problem.
Okay, do you have your proposal over here right now? Yeah, here's your proposal. Proposal problem set.
1, 2, right.
So this is problem set. That's good. It's problem. That's fair enough. Okay, that's good.
That's good. As always.
Okay, so group cohomology, I learned it from basically reading this book. In particular, there's a really, so this is Castle's Frolic, which is the, like, if you want to do algebraic number theory seriously, you should just take this book and read through it. It's the best book by far. It's extremely systematic and efficient. But it's you know, definitely a graduate level text, so I didn't use it for this course. But there's a nice chapter called Chapter 4 by Michael Attia of Fields, Mill, and so on fame, and Wall, and it's about cohomology of groups. And there's also a very useful chapter called Profinite Groups by somebody named Grunberg. And it is actually partly about Galois cohomology as well. So those two chapters are an extremely good introduction to the most basic things about group cohomology. Yeah, we'll be doing that.
Oh, we'll.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, yeah, definitely. But it's very important to have a good foundation for profinite groups in order to understand how to define Galois cohomology, in order to define Galois cohomology. Also, Sir's book, Local Fields, has a remarkably similar presentation of group cohomology to the one in here. It seems like one author must have copied the other author's notes, or both copied off of somebody.
Author?
What?
Who was the first author?
Castle's Frolic, and the authors are Tia and Wall. So you have a Tia and Wall and Sarah, and they have very, very similar treatments. You can look and you'll see that they're basically the same. But they're both extremely good, so I'm not complaining. Finally, for much, much more advanced, you know, a tour of really advanced topics in Galois cohomology, this book is really good. So it's Sarah's Galois cohomology book. But this is really aimed at, you know, a person who's totally mastered probably this entire book, and that's where this one starts out. So this assumes a lot more, but it tells you very, very deep things about Brouwer groups and cohomological dimension. There's a lot beyond just the basics of Galois cohomology. Duality theorems and so on. So it's a really, really deep subject. There are a lot of theorems about Galois cohomology. What we'll do today is start with the basics of group cohomology and a little bit of Galois cohomology. And I'm somewhat following very, very, very vaguely, I suppose, the Attia Wall article in here, just because that's where I learned it from. Okay, so first, if you have a group G, there's something associated to it called its group ring, ZG. And this is the free abelian group on the elements of G with multiplication coming from the multiplication on G. So for example, if G is a cyclic group of order 3, then you have ZG, which is, it has a basis consisting of the 1 of the group. So this is as a module, it's a direct sum of these three things. So if this has generator A, this element, and A squared, and then the multiplication on this free abelian group of rank 3 is given by the multiplication of the group. So a quick question, is this group ring the same thing as Z adjoining zeta 3, where zeta 3 is a primitive cube root of unity? As a ring. Are these the same as a ring? Where this is a cube root of unity?
No.
It has rank 2.
Right.
The other end of honor is
rank 3. This has rank 2. This has rank 3, so they can't possibly be the same. They're similar, but they're not the same. Here, zeta 3, well, zeta 3 satisfies some quadratic polynomial, whatever the second cyclotomic, or the third cyclotomic polynomial is, which is plus or minus.
X squared plus x plus 1.
So it's plus. So, so this is supposed to be 0. So you can replace zeta 3 squared by lower powers of zeta 3, whereas a squared is not equivalent in the group ring to lower powers of a. So they're just different means. So the answer is no, they're not isomorphic. So it's a group ring of a group. And if you do representation theory, then, for example, you take the whole group ring and consider it as a module for the action of the group, then you prove theorems about, for example, finding all the irreducible representations in there if you work over the complex numbers. But that's not the direction we're going to go in. All right, so group cohomology, well, what you do is you take, let's just fix for now. So now we're going to do group cohomology. And the first situation we'll consider is the case where G is a finite group. And A is a G module. What it means for A to be a G module is that A is an additive abelian group, and it has the structure of module over this ring, over ZG. So it's a module over the ring ZG. Notice that if G is not a commutative group, then this is not a commutative ring. So up until now, every ring we've ever considered has been commutative, but this is an example of one that isn't. So that's what a G module is. And the amazing thing is that you can associate abelian groups, H, N, G, A, one for each non-negative integer N, to this pair. And this is a functorial construction. It's actually functorial in both the first and second variable, though we'll think mainly about functorality in the second variable. That is to say, if you consider this for a fixed G as a function on the category of all G modules, you actually obtain a functor from the category of G modules to the category of abelian groups. And it's a functor with some very nice properties.
What is a functor?
A functor, if you have one category, do you know what a category is? You probably don't know what a category is if you don't know what a functor is. A category is a collection of objects and morphisms between those objects that satisfy certain axioms. For example, the category of abelian groups. Take all abelian, it's just a bunch of objects and a bunch of maps between the objects. So a very nice natural general notion. So the category of sets. Take all sets. It's not a set, because you know the set of all sets isn't a set, it's just a collection. And you take say maps between sets, all possible maps between any two sets, those are the maps. You have a bunch of objects, a bunch of maps. A functor is a function from one category to another category. But not only does it send objects of one category to objects of the other category, it sends the maps in one category to maps in the other category. So if you have object A here, it sends it to an object F of A. And if you have two objects, A and B, it sends the maps from A to B to maps from F of A to F of B. And you can think of tons and tons and tons of examples of this. For example, if you take the category of all abelian groups, with maps being homomorphisms of abelian groups, a functor is the forgetful functor, which just views an abelian group as a set. And that gives you a map from abelian groups to sets. And then it sends a morphism just to the induced morphism on sets. So that's an example. Or you could, there are millions of examples. Okay, so that's what a category is, and that's what a functor is. A functor is just a function between categories. But it's more than just a function on the objects, it's also a function on the morphisms. And then there's also a notion of natural transformation, but we won't need that. That's like a map between two functors. We won't need that at all. So this is an example. If you view it as a you view it as a function in the second variable, it's a functor on the category of G modules. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question about how that functor example works. Like, if you
mm-hmm.
forget
the specific example of abelian groups and forgetful functor?
Right, although I imagine
okay,
it applies
sure.
more in general.
Uh-huh.
So, like, in that case, if you have two different groups, like, say, I don't know, S3 and C6 or something.
Okay.
And you just kind of forget that they're groups. How do you distinguish between them?
They would map to the same set.
Okay.
And then the morphisms from one to the other, well, yeah, there's a morphism. So that,
well then, I mean, you could also
the two morphisms would map to self-maps of the set over here.
Okay, but then, I mean, you could also conceivably have two different sets on six objects, couldn't
you? It depends on whether I mean all sets or sets up to... identifying two sets if they happen to have the same cardinality, which would be two different categories.
Okay.
So you could take the category of cardinalities of sets, and you could take the category of all sets. And I guess in the category of all sets, then S3 and Z mod 6Z would be different. They're different sets. But in the category of sets modulo equivalence, that is, cardinalities, then they would be the same. Although I'm not certain that you can make the set of, or the collection of cardinalities into a category. Though I don't see why
but
not.
Like, in general, does a functor have to be, like, a function, like each element only
mm-hmm.
maps to one other thing?
That's right. It has to be, a functor is by definition an association for each object here is exactly one object here it maps to, and for each morphism here, you had exactly one morphism over here. You have an induced map on the HOM sets or the morphisms. So yes. So, in the case of the forgetful one, Z mod 6 and S3, if this is just the category of sets with no equivalence relation put on it, so it's not cardinalities, these are different sets. And they would map to different things. I mean, you have to define very precisely what you mean by Z mod 6Z and what you mean by S3, but you can do that. Like, S3 is a set of maps from a three-element set to itself. So it's a specific collection of maps, and you define what a map is. Z mod 6z would be the integers modulo 6 times the integers. So they're really literally very different sets. If you construct them, say, building them up using the axioms you set there. So they would map to different sets over here. Okay, that is definitely an aside. So now I have to tell you something about what these are. So what I'm going to do is precisely define H0 and H1, which are the only H's we're going to need for the discussion about the Mordell-Weil theorem, for Kummer theory, and so on. Though it's interesting also to consider H2, but I'll only precisely define H0 and H1, and then I'll give you a characterization that, in other words, a fact about Hn that completely determines Hn. And that will completely define these for you in the sense that there's no ambiguity about what they are, but it will not give you an explicit description in the case of H0 and H1. The description is very explicit for H0 and H1, but although it's very explicit for H1, it's not. It's still tricky to actually do anything with it. Okay, so here you go. So H0 is really straightforward. Here's the definition of H0 GA. It's the subgroup of elements in A with the property that G times A is equal to A for all G in G. So it's exactly the fixed points for the action of G on A, and that's a subgroup. So why is it a subgroup?
Because action by any element G is a homomorphism, so
mm-hmm.
so like it's closed under things like products or something, what the operation
yep.
is.
Okay, so like if you have two things in here, let's check it's closed under sum. So A plus B, if A and B are both fixed under the action of G, then because A is a module over ZG, this is distributive, so it's GA plus GB, and each of these are assumed to be fixed, so that's A plus B. So you see that the sum is also fixed. And likewise, if A is, well, let's see. You certainly have, because G of 0 is 0, you have that A minus A is fixed.
But because it's a module, that's G of A plus G of minus A.
And you know that G of A is fixed.
That's A plus G minus A.
So now if you take this equality, you see that G minus A has to be the additive inverse of A, just because A plus it is zero, and additive inverses are unique. So minus A is also fixed under G. So you have inverses and you have closure under addition, so this is a subgroup of A. In particular, it's a group. So that's the definition of H0. So far, that's not too complicated. H0 is simply the fixed point functor on the category of G modules. If you have any G module, fix a finite group, you can exert any module over it, then you can associate to it the submodule of elements of that module that are fixed under the action of G. And that's an example of a functor. Okay. Now let's define H1.
It's a functor from the category of G modules to itself?
Well, you could view it that way. I just want to think of it as a functor from the category of G modules to just abelian groups. This is a G module, but it's actually just has a trivial action. So it doesn't have any interesting G module structure, because GX, every element of G just acts as the identity on the fixed points. So let's view it as a functor from modules over G to groups, abelian groups. So thanks for that clarification. So H0, G comma dash, and it sends A to just the fixed points under G for A, which I'll denote that way. Okay? And that's a functor. So remember, a functor isn't just something that sends an object to an object. It also has to send a morphism to a morphism. So let's check that that really works here. If you have another G module V and a homomorphism between them, do you get a natural morphism between these two? Do you get a morphism there? So you do, just by restricting the morphism from A to B. AG and BG, these are subgroups of A and B, so the morphism from A to B, you can just restrict it, you get a morphism from AG to B, and it does in fact land inside of BG. Because this morphism is a morphism of ZG modules, so if you have something in here that's fixed by every element of G, the image of that thing will also be fixed by every element of G. So this is a functor. It's the fixed point functor on the category of G modules. So let's try some examples before doing H1. Okay, so let's just first take a completely arbitrary group G and let's consider our module to be, well, let's let it be Z, equipped with the trivial action of G. For any group G at all, you have Z as a module with the trivial action. By trivial action, I just mean that every element of G acts as the identity on Z. And it just acts as one of Z. So G times N is equal to N for all G and G and N and N, N and Z. So let's figure out what H0, G comma Z is. What is it? What are the elements that are fixed under the trivial action?
Z.
Right. Everything is fixed under the trivial action. So it's, what is it?
Z.
Z. Okay, let's try one where it's non-trivial. And hopefully this won't be hard. Let's take the group whose elements are plus or minus 1 acting on Z via multiplication. Okay, so minus 1 acts as minus 1 on Z. It sends something to its inverse, its additive inverse. and plus one just acts as one. This is a group of order two. And what are the elements of Z that are fixed under the action of this, under every element of this group?
Zero.
Just zero, that's right, it's a zero.
Okay.
Let's see. Here's one. Let's take a gala extension of Q. So when I write gal K over Q for K a number field,
the fact I'm writing gal K over Q, I'm implicitly assuming that K is a Galois extension.
I'll make that explicit, Galois. Okay, and that acts on K, where we just view K as an additive abelian group. What's H0?
Q.
Exactly, Q. And this is because K over Q is a normal extension. Separable. Well, no, but Galois means separable and normal, so one of those two, I guess it's separable. The fact that it's a separable extension means that if you have something that's fixed by all the Galois group, then it's in the base field. By the way, do you know an example that isn't separable? With characteristics, you really never find one, but if you take characteristic P, which is a nice example. Here, there's an automorphism, but the fixed field for P bar. If you take the automorphism, it still fixes T to the 1 over P. So you don't get anything. This sort of thing wouldn't work there. So to be more precise, you can view this field as adjoining a root of x to the P minus T. But look how x to the P minus T factors in characteristic P. It factors at x minus T to the 1 over P to the P. And that means this polynomial has exactly one root in this field. Automorphisms send roots of a polynomial to itself. Therefore, all the automorphisms of this field have to fix this element that you've adjoined. So this is an example of an inseparable extension, where the polynomial doesn't separate out when you factor it, and the roots don't separate. And here, it's not the case that the fixed field for the action of the automorphisms is the base field. So here the H0, for the group of automorphisms, sort of funny to write Galois of this thing, well, it would just be the whole thing.
So you're saying that is or isn't the Galois extension?
It's not Galois, because
okay.
It's not separable. Galois means normal and separable. And this one is not separable. And by Galois, I'll just write ought. Ought always makes sense. Not separable. Yes?
Isn't there a definition of a Galois that it's a splitting field? Or I guess there's it has to be a splitting field of a separable polynomial.
That's another way. But you can make a definition of Galois for, you know, in complete generality for extensions of fields. And for extensions of Q, you could define Galois to mean the splitting field of a polynomial. I don't think I'm answering your question at all.
I think I answered it.
Okay. Somebody else can you?
I thought I remembered that Galois meant splitting field of a polynomial,
right.
But it
that's
has to be separable.
So
right,
so.
But yeah, but that's, yeah, yeah.
Artin defines it as like
that's
where the group of automorphisms has the same order as the degree of the splitting field, or the degree of the field extension.
Yep. Yeah, that's an equivalent
right.
definition. I like normal and separable.
But that only
better.
Works for finite. So.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Right.
It only works for finite extensions, whereas normal and separable works more generally. But
E tends to omit things like infinite extensions or non-commutative rings or whatever.
Yeah.
But
I like normal and separable better.
Did you really need closure there?
I don't. I don't think I need it, but it just clarifies for me at least the picture a little. So don't worry. But
it just makes it completely clear that by T here I mean a transcendental. Otherwise I wouldn't put it there. I don't know. I mean, I definitely don't need the closure.
And that way you don't have to worry about whether you have the p-thirds of unity or something funny. It's just, I just think it clarifies the crucial point. Let's see.
We should try another example.
Okay.
What about the class group? What's fixed
for the class group? Does the Galois group even act on the class group? Let's see. So if you have a principal ideal, it gets sent to a principal ideal under the Galois group. And in general, the action of the Galois group is you take all the elements of an ideal and then you send them to their images under the Galois group. So you get a well-defined action of the Galois group on the class group. So what is fixed under that action?
What's above the prime?
What?
No.
That's true. The primes don't line over a given prime mark. To each other, but
so the
any thoughts though?
So okay, so let's look at all the ideals generated by the prime ideals.
Yeah,
so let's
true.
Look at which prime ideals could be fixed.
Okay.
Well, in order for it to be fixed, it has to be the only prime ideal lying over an integer prime.
Remember, it's up to equivalence. So it could be that.
Yeah.
Could be one prime goes to another prime, but they're equivalent. You have to worry about that, right? How about if I just put a question mark, because it's actually not at all obvious, and I think it depends a lot on the actual Galois group and the class group, right? I mean, it's a subtle question. Let's try a simpler example. Let's suppose K over Q is quadratic. Then can you say something? Then at least you have one element in the Galois group that's non-trivial, and you're asking for the elements of the class group that are fixed by that. So again, it's subtle.
I mean, there are the cases where it's,
yeah.
There's like what, eight cases where the class group is trivial.
Yeah, there's those.
Yeah,
so that's trivial.
Because quadratic isn't everything fixed.
Why do you think that?
Well, so the non-trivial one is either the non-trivial element is either conjugation or replacing something irrational with negative something irrational.
That's right.
And that should, well, that map should preserve ideals, and conjugation should preserve ideal classes.
One thing is that it could send P1 to P. It can swap two primes lying over a given prime of Q. In the quadratic case.
But I think they should be in the same class then.
Actually, what happens is their product would be trivial. So one would be the negative class of the other. Because P1 times P2 is the ideal generated by P, which is a principal ideal. So their inverses are negatives, however you want to think about it. They're inverses of each other in the group. So actually, if you have a class generated by a prime, then and that prime splits, then the automorphism, the non-trivial automorphism sends that to its inverse in the group.
Well,
so the
if it's so
it could be non-trivial.
If it's real though, we should still have that everything is fixed, I think, because it just sends like every element A to to either A or negative A. At least no, that's just like that's not right.
What if the class group were cyclic of order 3? Could you say anything then? Well, it just depends, again. I mean, I'm just trying to emphasize that it's kind of neat that already you have a question, which, given a number field, you now have another thing, which is the subgroup of the class group that's fixed. And what is it? And there's already potentially a small question here. Let's see, any other interesting examples? How about H0 gal A over Q E of K, where K is an elliptic curve over Q. I mean, sorry, E is an elliptic curve over Q. What is that?
It's the rational points in the curve.
That's right, E of Q. And why is it E of Q?
I mean, same as the top line up there.
Exactly the same. Okay, good. So these are examples of some H0s. Maybe we should do one more. So what about H0 Z mod NZ acting on
actually, wait, it's not really obvious in the previous case that a gal k over q has a well-defined action on e of k.
Right.
Why is that?
That's because the group operation on e is given by equations that have coefficients in q. It's given by, not equations, but formulas that have coefficients in q. And that's because of my assumption that the elliptic curve is defined over q. So if you take a point on the elliptic curve, so it's a solution. Well, I mean, when I say it's actually given by an equation, so it's y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. The group operation isn't so important at this point, just for the fact that this is preserved. So if you have a solution to this where x and y are elements of k and a and b are in q, then if you apply an automorphism to x and y, the same automorphism to x and y, you get another solution, because you're just applying it to both sides of the equation. So the set of solutions e of k is fixed by the action of, it's fixed as a set, it's left invariant by gal k over q. Okay, what about h0 of z mod nz acting on z mod nz? That makes sense. Does that make sense? Doesn't even make sense, does it? How about, z mod nz star, that group acts on z mod nz via exponentiation. So if you have an element of z mod nz, you can send it to another element of z mod nz by raising it to the power of a unit. And that's an invertible, that's a group action. Good. I'm happy with that. I think it works. This is just the automorphisms of z mod nz. So what's fixed under that?
Well, 0 and 1, certainly.
Yep. So 0 is fixed. Well, clearly I made a mistake. Because that's not
that's
a subgroup.
That's not a subgroup, yeah.
Okay, well, what did I do wrong? Okay, new question. What am I doing wrong?
Don't you also
not
like phi or
n? Can't be a module, obviously.
It's not a module.
Yeah.
The right thing is not a module.
Okay, why is it not a module?
Because
you don't get a subgroup. What? You don't get a subgroup. Yeah,
I mean,
obviously.
It's not a homomorphism. You don't have like the distributivity thing.
Right. Very good. Very
unless
good.
Unless it's like prime.
I mean, there may be, yeah, some. But still, whatever you get has to be a subgroup of this, and once you have one in, it would have to be the whole thing, so this just isn't going to work. And it's what you're saying, Elizabeth, so you have an automorph, these are automorphisms of this module, I mean of this abelian group, but they don't satisfy the module structure properties, so they have to distribute over addition, and they have to multiply. These just don't do that. So this is not a non-zero subgroup. What about h0 z mod nz comma z mod nz? So you just consider z mod nz as a module over itself.
So action is?
Just multiplication. It's a ring. So every ring is a module over itself. It's like the free module of rank 1 over itself.
Then it's just 0 then?
Except, remember that here I have to view this as z is the group ring over that. So. So here you have a group G, and then you consider modules over the group ring for that group. So sort of like we're thinking of Z mod NZ as a module over the group ring of Z mod NZ. So and also over here, that's what we had to show didn't happen, that this was not a module over the group ring. And actually, I think it is. Something dumb. Okay, so. So I think here you don't require that Z mod NZ is a module over Z mod NZ star. You require that it's a module over the group ring over Z mod NZ star, which is a different thing. And that is, I think that is the case.
You still don't have distributed.
Um,
Okay, so how does distributivity fail? So we'll take an element of Z mod NZ, namely sigma. So this is powering. So X goes to X to the A. And you're saying that sigma. I see. So you're right, you don't have it. But the argument isn't that it's not a module over this, the argument is that it's not a module over the group ring. Okay. And another way of putting that is that you require that, I mean, another equivalent way of thinking about this is that the group that's acting has to be a subgroup of the endomorphisms of your abelian group. Right? Then you get a module structure. So then you get the distributivity over addition. But it also has to be it also has to be a group. So I don't mean so let's see. So is there a problem with this one? This is a this is an additive group that's a collection of endomorphisms of Z mod N Z. So what do you get here? So you certainly get zero. Okay. But I don't mean the subgroup as, I just mean that as a set it has to be contained in, well, I mean, it doesn't have to be contained, but it's not the endomorphisms. Not be contained. So all I mean by this is that if you have an A that's a ZG module, then each element of G certainly gives you an endomorphism of A, since A is a module over ZG, and each element of G gives you an element of ZG. So if you don't have a map like this, then you've done something wrong. And here we do, but still doesn't work.
Doesn't work because I would think on the right this must be addition.
Yeah. Okay, what about H0 Z mod NZ star Z mod NZ star under multiplication?
Isn't it the same thing as before?
So first, does this make sense? Is Z mod NZ star a module over Z mod NZ star? Is it a Z? Is it a Z adjoined G module? Is it a ZG module? Or this is G?
Could I ask a question?
Please.
So you say in here that it's equivalent to say that A is a ZG module or B has some sort of action on A.
Right.
Could we, the action has to be, I guess, linear?
Yeah, absolutely. It has to be an action via endomorphisms, which was not at all the case with this one right here.
That example.
Yeah.
Here these are automorphisms, but
I just don't have a sense right now at all of what a ZG module looks like. I don't know if there's anything you could say about that.
That's what I'm trying to give you by doing examples and asking questions.
No, I know. I mean, I've been just thinking about all of these via the action. I just have no conception of, you know, what it would mean for Z mod NZ star to be a, you know, Z mod NZ star module.
Actually, I think we're screwing up still. I mean, this just doesn't seem... Here, this does act via endomorphisms on here. Because the action... I described the action incorrectly, but let's consider this. Let's consider this again, but with a different action than the one I described. The one I described was the following. I said, given an element here, you have exponentiation of that element by an element here.
Mm-hmm.
That was not a module action. And then that would have had fixed point 0.01. There's a different thing you can consider, which is given an element here, it multiplies on the left, it doesn't matter. You can multiply by that element. And that gives a map from Z mod NZ to itself. And that map is an endomorphism. So there was one way of trying to make this group act on the set, which just didn't work. But there's another way. So hopefully I start giving you So this. So another way to make z mod nz star act and z mod nz is via multiplication. So if you have an element A in z mod nz star, then you have the map that sends x to A times x. Okay? Now what's the fixed points for that map?
I think it's 0 and n over 2 if n is even, and 0.
N over 2.
If n is not even. Yeah.
That could be. Let's see. So we certainly have 0, and let's see about n over 2 if n is even. Well, that seems right. What do you guys think?
Because then a can't be even.
So it certainly has to get sent to it. So I mean, there's exactly one element of order 2, of additive order 2, if 2 happens to have, I mean, so for it's a general fact that everyone knows about cyclic groups, that you have a unique subgroup of each index, and equivalently, you know how many elements there are of a given order, and there can be only one element of order 2 in a cyclic group that has an element of order 2. And since these act by automorphisms, they have to send that element of order 2 to itself. So it would be 0 and n over 2. There is one, or is just 0, if n is odd. Okay, so here's another example of an H0. But notice how it's very important that you choose the action of this on here so that you get endomorphisms. So in the notes, when I say it's equivalent to giving an abelian group A equipped with an action of G on A, I mean an action via endomorphisms, by linear endomorphisms. So it's a map from the group G. So here's another way to think of a G module A. It's a pair, a group G, a module A, and a homomorphism from the group G to the group and A. But because G is a group, each element here will have an inverse. So under this homomorphism, you're going to land in the automorphism. So, okay.
So
yes.
In this case, I see how it works in terms of the functor, the fixed point functor. But how is this choice of a ZG module?
So here, so you want me to prove that Z mod NZ with this action is a G module for this group G.
Right.
Is that your question?
Right.
Okay, does anybody see that?
I mean, you just...
So we have a group G, we have a module A, and a homomorphism from G to end A. The homomorphism is, I send an element A to left multiplication by A, and you just have to verify that that's an endomorphism that preserves the addition and multiplication on Z mod. Oh, let's see. Multiplication.
If you really claim that, you know,
you don't need multiplication. That isn't. It's an abelian group, so we only care about. Don't care about the ring structure. It's under. It's this under addition, so it preserves the addition structure. Left multiplication preserves addition structure. Exponentiation didn't. Elizabeth, please.
Emily,
I'm sorry.
That's okay. So your example where you use Z mod NZ and left multiplication instead then would take you to, or wouldn't map you into odd A.
Yeah, it doesn't, let's see.
Because multiplication by zero is certainly not invertible.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, you don't think you need it to be an automorphism because you can have action defined by, like, everything goes to zero
right,
no matter what.
I mean, I agree, but that's contradicts what you just said.
No, I think it has to be invertible, because this is a group. So if you have an element in here, this is a there's definitely an issue with how I'm describing this. So I don't mean that. Yeah. So I guess end A is a group under addition with identity element 0. So you would think that I mean this to be a group homomorphism, meaning that the identity element of G would go to 0, and that's the reasoning you're using, I think. But that's not what I mean. It's It's really, it's a homomorphism from G to ought A, where by ought A I mean the invertible endomorphisms of A. And where ought A has a group structure with identity element, the identity automorphism.
Okay, well, I don't think multiplication by zero is invertible.
So zero is not an element of Z mod and Z star.
No, it's exactly
down here
is
zero. Yes, so this you don't get an action here either.
Right.
If you take multiplication, that's right.
So that's
right.
That was wrong.
Yes,
so
this is not an action.
Okay.
Well, can you find the action there to be by addition rather than multiplication? Or
you can consider that. Okay, so if I declare the action to be the action by multiplication, it's not an action. I don't get automorphisms.
Okay,
so
my addition's not
okay,
anyway.
So by zero, then that would be by translation. Like, one would send A to A plus one. That won't be an action either, because you don't get endomorphisms. These are not automorphisms of A as a set. They're automorphisms of A as an abelian group. Hence, they are automatically endomorphisms. So this is where it's a you have a map here, but this map is a homomorphism. So.
The map
this is it.
From
G
to
A, and a map from G to odd A. Yes. So for a general action of a group on a set, you say that the group G acts on a set X if you have a map, a homomorphism from G to odd X. For a set, odd X is just the set of all permutations of the set X. For an abelian group, odd A means all of the automorphisms of the abelian group that preserve the abelian group structure, otherwise known as call those endomorphisms. They also have the property that they're endomorphisms.
But endomorphisms don't have to be invertible, correct?
No.
Okay.
No. So endomorphisms include, for example, zeros. So I think that it's completely irrelevant to include those in this picture. Let's write odd A, and then emphasize that here I mean automorphisms
yes.
of abelian groups.
I don't get
why it's not. Like, if it goes into odd A, then you get things like all representations are faithful, don't you?
Oh, it's just a homomorphism.
Yeah, but I mean, you can also say representation is giving a G-module structure to a vector space.
Yep.
And then if you map into ought, then like the only thing that it should be able to kill is...
But faithful means that this is injective.
Wait, I thought I meant that...
No, I
think
it's injective.
Yeah.
So you're okay now?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've made what seemed like a very, very simple definition appear somewhat more complicated. Amazingly so. But I think that you probably are starting to get a better sense of what this really means by observing what happens in these various examples. It's just a group that acts on an abelian group, which is a little more than acting on a set. You have the additional structure that you're preserving, the additional on the abelian group. And that works for, so let's check these examples that we had so far. So first, the trivial action, there's no problem there. You're mapping everything to one. Here, you're acting on K under addition. And automorphisms certainly have the property that that's just one of the special properties that you have. Here on the class group, it preserves I checked that it preserves multiplication. So if you have ideals I and j, sigma of I times j is sigma of I times sigma of j. Because I times j is by definition the ideal generated by all products. So you have an action here. Here, to know that you have an action, not only that set E of K is preserved, you also have to check that the group structure is preserved. So if you have P and Q, then sigma of P plus Q is sigma of P plus sigma of Q. But that's okay because we assumed our elliptic curve was defined over the base field, Q. Okay, so that's H0. Now H1. So here's what H1 is. Just remember, already even an H0 can be slightly subtle. Something can happen there. It's not completely trivial to be the fixed point function. H1 G comma A is it's one co-cycles modulo one co-boundaries.
And when cocycles are all maps F, they're just set theoretic maps from G to A to satisfy a certain property. So these are set theoretic maps. When I say set theoretic, I'm just emphasizing that they're not group homomorphisms in general, such that F of sigma tau is F of sigma plus sigma F of tau for all sigma tau in G. So that's what the one cocycles are. They're also known as crossed homomorphisms. The condition is similar to a homomorphism, but if the action of the group on A is non-trivial, it's not quite a homomorphism. In a special case, when your group acts, when every element of the group acts as the identity on A, this just disappears, and these are homomorphisms. Okay. Now, when co-boundaries, there are also maps from G to A, but they're of a special form. There's a way to construct a map from G to A associated to an element of A. So these are maps that are of the form F of sigma equals sigma of A, well, sigma A minus A. So I'll call this F sub A. So for each element of A, you can construct a one cocycle. And a one cocycle constructed in that way is called a one coboundary. And H1 is the one cocycles modulo the one coboundaries. The obvious exercise to do at this point is to verify that every function on the bottom is in fact a function that satisfies the condition on the top. Right?
We also need to check that they form a group.
Yes, we need to check they form a group. So which do you want to do first? Probably better to check that the one cocycles form a group, because that might be useful elsewhere. So let's check that one cocycles form a group. So if you have two one cocycles, F and G, you have to check that their sum also has that property. So you have to say F plus G of sigma tau. Well, yeah, it's a group under addition.
Okay.
Remember, it's the images are in A, so by sum I mean pointwise sum. The definition of F plus G is for each element that you're evaluating on, you evaluate F on that element, you evaluate G on that element, and then you sum up the result in A. So here the definition of F plus G of sigma tau is F of sigma tau plus G of sigma tau. Okay, but F and G are both one cocycles, so we can use the property that they satisfy. Anyway, it's F of sigma plus sigma F of tau, and G is G of sigma plus sigma G of tau, and you get that. But now we can just rearrange this, and you get F of sigma plus G of sigma plus, now using the fact that these act in a way that preserves the group structure, you get that this is sigma F of tau plus G of tau. Now using the definition of addition for one cocycles, this latter thing is F plus G of sigma plus sigma F plus G of tau. And that's exactly the one cocycle condition. So one cocycles are closed under addition. If you have a one cocycle, it's negative, is just, you send everything to the negative thing, F of, the negative of F of sigma is, F sigma goes to minus F of sigma. So you also have inverses, so these do form a group. Okay, and then the second thing is that one co-boundaries are in fact one cocycles. Every one co-boundary is a one cocycle. This is a subgroup. So let's check that. So if you have one coboundary associated to an element in capital A, so F sub little a, we need to compute F sub little a of sigma tau and verify the crossed homomorphism condition, the one cocycle condition. So what is this? This is by definition sigma tau a minus a. On the other hand, you have S of A of sigma plus sigma S of A of tau, and that's equal to S of A of sigma is sigma A minus A plus sigma of F sub A of tau. F sub A of tau is tau A minus A. So it's just sigma A minus A plus sigma tau A minus sigma A. And luckily, you have cancellation of these two things, and you end up with sigma tau A minus A. Which shows that, in fact, F sub A is a one cocycle. And the only thing that you might worry about now is, why did a set of F sub A's form a group? But you have F sub A plus F sub B of sigma. We just need to check that this is an F sub something. So this is sigma A minus A plus sigma B minus B, and that's sigma of A plus B minus A plus B, which is F sub A plus B of sigma. So in fact, this is a group, and it's a group because if you have, it's closed under addition and also negatives. So F sub A plus F sub B is F sub A plus B. Okay, questions?
Is there any sort of co-boundary operator on just like set theoretic maps in general such that we get
so this is the kernel?
In the usual sense? Right.
I'm sure there is. Let's see. Okay, so first, here's something. So notice that you have a map from H0 to V6. I mean, not from H0, but from A. A maps to one cocycles, so called C1. C1 G comma A. And the map is A goes to F sub A. What are the co-boundaries that are 0? Those are exactly the elements of H0. If a co-boundary is the 0 map, that means that A is actually in H0. So the kernel of this is H0 G comma A. So I've just shifted back one from the question you're asking. But the one co-boundaries here are exactly the A's that give you the trivial one co-boundary are exactly the elements of H0. They're the fixed points. Okay, so now the next question, is there a map from from one cocycles to two cocycles such that these are exactly the things in the kernel of that map? And the answer is yes, but I have to tell you what two cocycles are in order to explain that, and I'm not going to do that. But you can describe it in all these articles. But yes, there is a map. So the answer to your question is yes. Okay. You can describe two cocycles as maps from G cross G to A with certain properties. So that defines H1 GA. Okay. That's a definition. But it's already a little bit more subtle than the definition of H0. There's one nice example, one nice case is when the action is trivial. So if G acts trivially on A, i.e. the map from G to ought A is the identity map. Is the map that sends everything to the identity is has image 1. Then H1GA is isomorphic to Hom G comma A. Okay, does anybody see why that is?
Because the top is homomorphic to the bottom is trivial.
Exactly. The bottom is 0, the top is homomorphism. So pattern for this. So that's one very nice case. So let's compute H1G comma Z, where Z has the trivial action. Why?
G is finite.
Yep. There's no homomorphism from a finite group to an infinite group. Infinite torsion free group. So this has to be 0. What about, let's see, try another one.
they take plus or minus 1 acting on z, but non-trivially, where minus 1 acts by minus 1. So let's see if we can figure out what that is. So remember, we did that before for h0, and we got 0. There's nothing that's fixed. But now we're asking about h1. We can't use this Hahn thing anymore because the action is non-trivial. So what is that group? It's some group. Z mod 2z, you guess? Okay, can you explain why? It's a good guess.
The bottom thing, the co-boundaries are just 2z, are there just, no.
There. I mean, they take 1 to 0 and the other to minus 2a.
Yep, right. So first, there's exactly one non-trivial element of this group. So you can think of a cocycle, a one cocycle. To give a one cocycle, in particular, you could just give the image of that one non-trivial element. That completely determines the cocycle. Now let's figure out what the cocycle condition is. So let's see.
Can you repeat what you just said?
Yes. So this group has order 2. If you have a cocycle, the identity element of the group, the identity element of the group, I think, just goes to the zero element always. Let me make sure that's true. So if you take...
yeah.
And
you
substitute
if you take
1 for sigma and tau.
Yep.
Yeah, substitute 1 for this, you get f of sigma is equal to f of sigma plus f of sigma, which in z, certainly that implies that f of sigma is 0. So... So if we're going to get a cocycle f from G, which is a group of order 2, to Z, all we have to do is give the image of minus 1, and that will completely determine our cocycle. So let's check, what is the cocycle condition? Let's see if that's any condition. So we have two elements in our group. We have the element 1 and we have the element minus 1. And let's just say we send the element minus 1 to N, any integers, okay? Let's see if there's any condition at all put on N for this to be a one cocycle. So let's just look at this condition.
Well, there's not a condition if sigma and tau are both minus 1.
Right, if sigma...
is that just the identity?
Okay, on the left you have 0, on the right you have f of minus 1...
Minus
f of... minus, well, it's just 0. So you have f of minus 1 is...
equal to f minus 1.
Wait, hold on, I'm going to write it down. So you have one condition, if you make them both equal to minus 1, is that f of minus 1 times f of minus 1, which is certainly 0, on the other hand, has to be f of minus 1, which is n, minus f of minus 1, which is n. Okay, so there's no condition at all there. And the other thing you have to check is, we're by definition, our cocycle sends 0 to 0, since we know we're going to get nowhere otherwise. And f of minus 1 times 1. So what does the condition say? It says that that should be f of minus 1, which is n, minus 0. Okay? So that's okay. That certainly matches with how we defined it. And if you switch it around the other way, then it says you get 0 plus n. And that's true also. So any n you want gives you a cocycle. Now the co-boundaries are... what? They're minus 2 times something. So it's z mod 2z. OK, so good job. This is z mod 2z. OK, so that's h1. And you can also consider h1s here, too. For example, you could ask, what is H1 gal k over q comma k? And it turns out that that is 0. And you can also ask about H1 gal k over q k star. And that's also 0. You get automorphisms preserve the multiplicative structure also. And the fact that this is 0 is a little bit more non-trivial. It's easily equivalent to Hilbert's theorem 90. And
I probably will prove this. I'll either prove it next week or make it an exercise. It uses linear independence of automorphisms and a little trick. Ooh, sorry. That would be smaller than the guitar. Okay, so that's another example. Okay, so what about the general HNs? So instead of giving you an explicit construction, I'll state a theorem that completely determines them. And you could view this as a definition or a characterization or whatever. So here's the theorem. Okay, the HN GA have the following properties. State some properties, and then remark, the end of the theorem is the statement, and these uniquely determine HNGA. Okay, so here are the three properties. One, H0 is as we defined it. Okay, two, second one requires a little more work to state. So there's a notion of co-induced module, a way to go from a set to a G module. And here's a way. If you have any set at all with a G action, any abelian group. Any abelian group. Then you can consider A, which is all group homomorphisms from ZG to X. And this is a ZG module. This is a G module. So let's see, what's the structure? So first, it's an abelian group, because if you have two homomorphisms into an abelian group, you can add them together and get another homomorphism to an abelian group. And if you have a homomorphism of phi, you need to make G act on it. So the image of phi under sigma acts on X by I hope I don't get the order backwards. So I get a left action. That's, we haven't really worried about that. So this gives another homomorphism, because you could just think about this as, given a homomorphism phi, multiplication by sigma or sigma inverse is a homomorphism from ZG to itself, and I'm just precomposing with that homomorphism. So I get another homomorphism from ZG to X. So an abelian group of this form is called co-induced. And the second defining property is that HNGA is zero for co-induced. For n greater than or equal to 1. So these are cohomologically trivial. These are elements of the category of G modules which are cohomologically trivial. They're trivial for every HI. And the third property is that if 0, A, B, C, 0 is a short exact sequence, of G modules, then there's a long exact sequence zero
H zero G A H zero G P H zero G C. And there's a notion of exact functor. A functor is exact if whenever you take a short exact sequence and apply it to each thing in the sequence, you get another exact sequence. The fixed point functor is not, in general, an exact functor. And something that measures, well, what happens is instead of getting an exact sequence from an exact sequence, you get a sequence that is exact, but it's not a short exact sequence. The next thing is H1GA, then H1GB, and then H1GC, and then H2GA, and it keeps going forever. So you have H2s, then you have H3s, then you have H4s, and H5s, and H6s. After a while, they might all be zero, depending on properties of your group and your modules. But
are we guaranteed that they're getting smaller? Yeah.
Wait, what?
Are they getting smaller for sure?
Smaller? No. Don't think they have to get smaller. For example, with this example, H0 was trivial and H1 had order 2. So the higher HIs might not be smaller. Also, when your group is cyclic, then you have some nice periodicity properties, or the cardinality is periodic in a simple sense.
So you can replace the second condition with an easier one.
Sure.
That if X is
a
G module, then there exists an A module containing it such that HN of GA is zero.
Okay, so everything that's inside of something that's homologically trivial.
Yes.
Okay, so I'll take your word for that. So these are three properties. The first one isn't so bad. That's just the definition that we used. The second one is not so good, but it's not horrible. It just says that there are a bunch of G modules for which the cohomology is all trivial. And this is a similar condition. He says that for any A, there's a B, so the cohomology is trivial in that particular thing. And here I'm telling you specifically a collection of A's such that cohomology is trivial on these. If you for example, try to compute H1 of one of these, you'll find that it's trivial. And the third condition is that you have associated to a short exact sequence, you have a long exact sequence. So these are three properties that cohomology has, and the cohomology is completely determined by having these three properties. What that means is that if you want to prove something about H17 G, A, it must be possible to deduce it just from these properties. Since there are no other, it has to be possible. Anything that you can deduce about cohomology must be deducible from these three properties. And that gives you a sense of why group cohomology arguments involve, well, occasionally using what H0 is. Sometimes you introduce these co-induced modules or similar modules, and notice that they're zero in order to make various definitions. And very, very often what you do is you write down an exact sequence and then look at the corresponding long exact sequence, and then try to say something about the terms in the sequence. And huge amounts of arguments that you see about group cohomology involve just that sort of reasoning. You can deduce all kinds of interesting things about H1s, for example, just by writing down an appropriate exact sequence and then doing something with it. So, so there's one example in the notes where we figure out what H2 G, Z is for any G just by chasing an exact sequence. So let's do that. But we can also another thing that might be intriguing to look at is, okay, take this is an exact sequence of modules over plus or minus one.
That's
working. Must have said something really dumb. Okay, so take g to be plus or minus one, and then z is a modulo for plus or minus one, where the action is multiplication by minus one. Same here, multiplication by two certainly behaves well, it's a homomorphism. And then the co-kernel z mod 2z. So let's take this short exact sequence and then consider the long exact sequence and see if we can work, see if we can just formally use these properties to deduce what we had deduced before, namely that this was z mod 2z. I don't know whether we will be able to easily, because I haven't thought about this particular thing, but it should be possible. And if it works, then it'll be a very nice example. And if it doesn't, oops, I shouldn't have risked it, and I should have done the HT thing. But let's take the short, let's consider the long exact sequence. So first we have 0, H0, G, comma, Z. All right, I'll actually write plus or minus 1 here. So what is that?
0.
And then you have H0 plus or minus 1 Z. What is that?
0.
And you have H0 plus or minus 1 Z mod 2Z. What is that?
Z mod 2Z.
That's right, Z mod 2Z. Okay, and then we have H1 plus or minus 1 Z, the thing that's somewhat mysterious. And you have this map, which is multiplication by 2, because that's what it is on the underlying co-cycles. H1 plus or minus 1 comma Z. And then you have H1 plus or minus 1 Z mod 2Z. And H2 plus or minus 1 comma Z, etc. Okay, here you have a trivial action because minus 1x trivially on Z mod 2Z. So this is just Hom. So this is a group of order 2. Okay, that Z mod 2Z injects into this, and it's the kernel of multiplication by 2 on this because of the exactness of the sequence. The image of this, so first this map is, since you have a 0 here, this map is injective, so you have a Z mod 2Z that sits inside of here, and the image of that is the kernel of this, so it's the kernel of multiplication by 2 here. So you find that H1 plus or minus 1 comma z, the kernel of multiplication by 2 is equal to z mod 2z, just from chasing this diagram.
Question?
Yes?
How do you know that the homomorphism between those is the multiplication?
Because on the underlying co-cycles it is. On A, it's multiplication by 2. And this map is just the map induced by, so that's I didn't explicitly state that, but it's the map induced by the underlying map on co-cycles.
Here.
That's the map. So there's a map on one co-cycles to a map on one co-cycles, and that induces this map on each ones. And it is multiplication by 2 on the co-cycles, so it's certainly multiplication by 2 on the quotient of the co-cycles mod co-boundaries. Okay? So that's how you know that. So you get this is Z mod 2Z, and from this you get that the image of 2 times it is the kernel of this map. There's one other fact, which is that the order of this group annihilates the cohomology, and this group here has order 2, so this group has to be annihilated by 2, so this has to be the 0 map. So you really have to have isomorphism without the 2 here, but that requires introduction of a little bit more theory. So I'll stop there, but formally, and the additional theory you get also formally from these properties. So you get this just from what we've done so far. And this is a lot easier than actually writing down co-cycles and co-boundaries. You just get it by chasing the diagram, and you get at least this part of the correct statement. Another chase would get you that this thing has order 2. So, okay, so I'm done. And then on Tuesday, what I'm going to do is talk more about Galois cohomology, Kummer theory, and elliptic curves.
Yes, do you ever check out Washington's
faculty? Check out what?
Washington's faculty.
Ah, well, let me give you. So it says here you need 3 copies collated with the nomination form and the documentation. here is the three copies of the nomination form, three copies of, well, not really the, yeah, the evaluation. So you just have to take this and collate it. And you can include one of these, one of the nicer copies, and you can just use these photocopies, whichever you want.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, by the way,
yes.
So I, the thing with the class,